This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Recently, the technology company Qualcomm announced a $10 million prize to anyone who can invent a medical tricorder. That's right, the machine that Dr. McCoy used in Star Trek to diagnose everything from Rigelian fever to the phage. The thing is, doctors are already using handheld technology to do some diagnosis. Smartphones.
What we decided to do was to really take mobile devices that a lot of us know about these days, but really try to build in the ability that reference lab diagnostics would have.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear how doctors in Africa are using smartphones to fight disease. We'll also hear about a hip-hop MC who's using music to teach boys to be men and spend an academic minute gassing up the galaxy. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. There are some places in the world where access to laboratory diagnostics and patients' health records can be challenging. In the April 2013 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry, Dr. Samuel Sia and his colleagues described a low-cost mobile device that combines cell phone and satellite communication technologies along with fluid miniaturization techniques for performing all of the functions of an enzyme-linked immunoassay for the diagnosis of disease. They tested their new device's ability to perform HIV screening in Rwanda and synchronized results in real time with electronic health records. Dr. Sia is an associate professor of biomedical engineering at Columbia University. In that piece in Clinical Chemistry, they described a point-of-care handheld analyzer called an M-chip device. I asked Dr. Sia to talk a little bit about its design and its application.
Sure, Bob, and thanks for having me here. So our vision was to take reference laboratory tests that tell you what you have in your blood and provide that capability in the hands of clinicians and patients and even consumers everywhere. And we want to do it in a way that is fully automated so that really anyone can run this device without previous training and will get performance that is comparable to a reference lab. And so what we decided to do was to really take inspiration from mobile devices that a lot of us know about these days, but really try to build in the ability that reference lab diagnostics would have. So really provide sort of a healthcare diagnostic ability. And the way it would work is you would prick a finger just like you would do to get your glucose tested, say, for a diabetic patients. This can be done anywhere. And that little drop of blood would then go into a little tiny plastic chip. And then that chip goes into this mobile device and you press a button and you'll get the result in 15 minutes, a procedure that normally takes hours to do in one of these labs. And not only that, the synchronization with the cloud in terms of your results with your patient records is also automated. So it doesn't matter where you are in the world. In fact, we did this study in sub-Saharan Africa. Those results will automatically be synchronized with the patient records as well.
This use of mobile device or smartphone technology appears to be a first in medical diagnostics. Can you tell us how you came to capitalize on smartphones?
Well, a lot of us really see the power, and we are familiar with the power as everyday consumers of being able to do things on the go and do it in a connected way so that we have a two-way communication with records that are stored on a server somewhere. So we can do a lot of things now in our hands with smartphones, but one of the few things that we can't do is things that are related to health. And really, when I say that, I mean core healthcare services, such as diagnostics. There are other mHealth capabilities that one is beginning to be able to do, but really not some of these core diagnostic tests. And I think a lot of people would like to monitor their diseases and their conditions and their wellness and have that power in their own hands. And so we realized that to be able to not only do these tests in a mobile way, but do it in a way that makes the patient or the clinician actually connected to the record stored somewhere else is very powerful. And so that's something that we capitalized on by using these existing cell phone networks. We used GSM out in Africa, and even when the network was down, we could connect to orbiting satellites. And so it doesn't really matter where you are in the world, you can stay connected. And then the other way around is not just the person in the field being able to do this and stay connected. You also have the person sitting in a government office or in a centralized location, maybe it's your doctor back home, who can actually monitor what's going on in the field, and you can actually see what the diagnostics results are in real time and allocate your resources and conduct epidemiological studies that way and monitor what disease outbreaks and so forth. So I think a lot of us really understand the power of being connected via smartphones, and we're trying to provide some of the core healthcare services along with that.
You did your field tests on this device in Rwanda. How did you come to choose that country?
We worked with a clinical collaborator. We worked with a great set of collaborators on this project, industry collaborators, Opco Diagnostics, as well as a clinical collaborator, ICAP at Columbia. And ICAP already has a lot of work done in Rwanda on AIDS patients, and we decided to capitalize on that. And so when we ended up working in Rwanda, we ended up really having to have the expertise of a lot of the Rwandan collaborators. So this study would not have been possible without them either. We worked in a Rwandan hospital as well as two health clinics there. So I think, you know, we had our clinical collaborator already had studies going on in Rwanda. That's one reason. But I think another reason is also that there's a huge need in sub-Saharan Africa for these kinds of devices, because you really need to have diagnosis take place in places that are outside of hospitals when you are in developing countries. A lot of those patients don't have access to go back to hospitals. Another reason I think that we found out that became very interesting is there's really a huge opportunity for innovation in working in these countries. They're not encumbered by existing infrastructure and existing record-keeping systems and so forth. They are willing to innovate and go and straight to the solution that is really best adapted for them and leapfrog to the solution. So cell phones is a great example of that. They didn't have to go through the landline phones. And here, I think there's a similar opportunity to innovate. And so there's already a huge adoption of electronic health records in the developing world. And we were hoping to capitalize on that. And so even if ultimately we want to have such a device back here at home as well, I think not only doing this in Rwanda, where we have existing collaborators with a huge clinical need, we actually found that we had a great way to explore what the possibilities were with electronic records. And these are things that we can learn to bring back home as well in the future.
You've compared your testing device to laboratory-based FDA-approved methods. Just how well do they compare?
So in this study in publishing clinical chemistry, we tested for just HIV. In previous work, we published, we also tested a dual test, HIV syphilis. And really, we want to go into a panel test for multiple diseases, which is really going to cost pretty much the same per card. But in this particular case, it was just HIV. And so we ended up getting performance that was really high, 99 to 100% in sensitivity and specificity. Current FDA-approved HIV rapid tests, such as the OraSure test, are also very accurate in their controlled trials. There are some published results which suggested that some of these rapid tests perform less accurately in the field. You have to, you know, really interpret the band, and that's especially a problem for so-called weak positive results, results that are not clearly strongly positive, but they are positive. The patient is positive for HIV, say, but they just don't have a lot of antibodies developed yet, maybe in the early stages of infection and so forth. And in a lot of these cases, the band is weak, and you could mistakenly let that patient go with some of these rapid tests as they are conducted in real settings and interpreted and run by real users in the field. And so I think one advantage that we have, not only in that we can match the analytical performance in a reference lab, is that we can objectively pick up some of these weekly positive results, and that was shown in this paper. And I think overall, the automation that we have in our device will just minimize the user variability and user error. There is no subjective reading of the band. Everything is objectively measured and determined for you and displayed on the mobile device. And those results actually go straight to the cloud if you wish. And so there's not much variability in the performance once you have such an automated device. And so I think from straight analytical performance, we did at least as well as the rapid test, and we did really much closer to the reference lab testing. But by even having this automation in the field under real settings, I think we may have some advantages in reducing user error and variability as well.
You mentioned that you can see this technology being used in conditions other than HIV. What other diseases or types of diseases do you see best suited for this technology?
Well, our device right now in the developing world, we really are interested in making it available to pregnant women. That is one sector of the population we're particularly interested in for prenatal, antenatal care. And so HIV and other STDs, for example, syphilis and other STDs as well. In the case of syphilis, the pregnant woman could actually have stillbirths if they're not diagnosed and treated properly. So the burden of syphilis, for example, is actually just as high as malaria for a pregnant woman. So these are very serious conditions that we think we can offer in a panel test with just one finger prick of blood, very low cost, about right now it seems like, I think, $2 per panel test that we'll be able to offer this for. So that HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, and other infectious diseases for the developing world is the panel that we're looking at. Now, for the U.S., the conditions would be different that we would want to address, and that may be conditions such as chronic diseases or wellness for the average consumer. And so I think there's a lot of potential for this depending on which market we're talking about.
Can the cost restrict the use of this in some of the developing countries?
Yeah, I mean, in the developing countries, cost is a big constraint. So we think based on the price point of the current rapid tests, for example, the HIV rapid tests are used very widely in the developing world today, and they cost about $1. And so we think by having some advantages with just the HIV test plus some of these other tests we're offering, the $2 price point should be a reasonable price point based on what is already going on out there with the current HIV rapid tests. But I do think that the price point is something that is important, but it has to be always assessed with respect to the benefit that you are getting. And so sometimes it's easy to just kind of throw out assumptions out there and say, well, things have to be, you know, absolutely dirt cheap if you're going to be in Africa. And I think there's just a lot of cases that have shown that such an analysis would not be complete if you were not accounting for the benefit as well. Cell phones are very popular, and they're not dirt cheap. They also have to be charged. But people are willing to pay for that if they think they're getting value out of it. And same thing with diagnostics. And it depends on what applications you are going after, because some types of diagnostics just provide much higher value as well. And so I think with our panel that we're looking at, around $2, I think, is a price point that the market will ultimately bear out, whether it's donors that are going to be purchasing the tests or the government or the clinics.
You mentioned you could see this coming to the U.S. and other countries that are, you know, have more resources. Do you see a big future for these devices in the developed world?
Absolutely. I mean, I just cannot be more excited about that potential. It's going to happen. Health is really one of the last bastions that has yet to be conquered in a mobile phone method. And so it's really just a matter of time that everyone can do everything else on their smartphones as well as do a lot of core healthcare services. But unfortunately, there's quite a bit of inertia to overcome in order for that vision to happen. And so it will probably take a few more years for the regulatory environment to catch up, for the business models to catch up, for the consumers to understand what they can do with that information. But it's really a matter of when and not if that a lot of these core healthcare services will be provided at mobile settings and up to the choosings of consumers rather than being dictated by what the insurers would have to approve. But the price points have to be, I think, lower in order for mass adoption by consumers. You know, not to mention that the technology has to be automated and very, very friendly and simple to use, because the bar has been set already. Consumers are accustomed to all the other things that they can do on smartphones. But the sky's the limit here, but there are some unique challenges to getting some of these health technologies on the smartphones, challenges that are not in place for most of the existing smartphone capabilities.
Well, finally, Doctor, let's look ahead. What's next for you and your team?
We really want to finish what we started 10 years ago, working on this technology for the developing world. And so we want to take this to the finish line and really get it to a point where the device is saving patients' lives. And I think even saving one life for me would really be the first, I think, real success for this technology. That moment hopefully will come, and that's what I think really drives a lot of us to do this work in our collaborative team here. And myself, I think this market in the U.S. is also very interesting, where we can actually get consumers engaged and in charge of their own healthcare decisions, and diagnostics is really the gateway to a lot of healthcare services. And so there's a lot of potential there for us to contribute to, and hopefully we'll be able to do that.
Dr. Samuel Sia is an associate professor of biomedical engineering at Columbia University. You can read more about this topic in the April 2013 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Still to come, a hip-hop musician is using his art to reach young men. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1233. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Saeed Brent mentors young men using an unusual tool, hip-hop. Lauren Kirby from the SALT Radio Institute brings us this portrait of an artist using music to try and make a difference in young men's lives.
It's 3 o'clock in Lincoln Middle School. Outside an empty classroom, Mo challenges Mike to a battle rap while they wait for Saeed.
It's so great.
Saeed Brent is a 32-year-old MC who runs a weekly after-school workshop.
How to vomit.
Kids, I don't want you to do it.
The focus of this semester's workshop? What it means to be a man.
So everybody, I'm going to do the hook.
I want to be a man, but I'm still a boy. I want to be a man, but...
That whole adulthood... Okay, 18 maybe it starts legally. The government says it starts at 18. You're 14. That's 4 years from now. What now? So you start thinking about it now, 7th, 8th grade, high school, I think it's pretty good. The fact that they're exploring it through hip-hop, I think it's pretty cool.
I want to be a man like Malcolm X.
It's powerful music. Hip-hop is powerful. And it's beautiful. I mean, you know, you write words on paper and they rhyme and flow together. You match it with a great beat. Like, it's awesome.
What kind of man are you being right now? Right. A man's got two eyes. What's up?
So it's true. Hip-hop is a powerful medium. And middle school is a great time to be exploring the responsibility of your imminent manhood. But it's also true that the image of masculinity typically associated with hip-hop is a negative one.
Life with my face, man. I go through life with my...
It's all inappropriate. all that stuff on the radio is pretty much inappropriate. And what it does to the psyche and all the images it conjures up there and makes okay is not good. But it's challenging, so we at least want to challenge them to look at things a little differently.
Part of looking at things differently means learning about new kinds of hip-hop. hip-hop that is socially conscious, sometimes even politically charged. A kind of hip-hop that strays from the stereotypical subject matter of drugs, guns, and money.
I want to be different, unlike the known association. I want to give
part of the thing that we do in this workshop is step away from the MTV a little bit, BET. Like, there's a lot of hip-hop out there that I want to expose them to. Like Mos Def always talks about, he's a bookworm, you know what I mean? I love that. You know, he's cool enough, but smart enough and kind of more open-minded enough to take it to another level.
Kind of like you can still be into hip-hop, you can still be cool and want to get your law degree.
Exactly.
Went through college and got his bachelor degree. And at age 25, lawyer, you see, but all this race.
There's some great hip-hop out there, but just turn on the radio, you know what I mean? And all they're getting is this crap. Hip-hop's everywhere. So they've got plenty of other examples out there. And, you know, everybody wants to emulate who they really like and adore and who they look up to. And that sucks because there's stuff you can't defend anymore. But nobody's trying to be like the underground cats. Nobody wants to be the underground rapper who's speaking, you know, on some conscious level or really making music.
Stop if you feel good.
The definition of being a man that's put out there was tough, gun-toting. This is what is expected of you as a man, according to them, and it's huge, it's out there. So I think hip-hop actually is the best way to do this because of what is really put out there. So in hip-hop, for you to explore a different way and to really put how you feel being a man is, I think it's important that they explore it. This is a medium that's out there, but make it yours. It's kind of...
Right, like adulthood is out there. How are you going to make it yours?
Exactly. I like that. Exactly.
I'm still a boy. I want to be a man, but I'm still a boy.
For Salt Radio, man, I'm Lauren Kirby.
Where exactly do galaxies go to gas up and get a little energy boost? Well, that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. There are billions of galaxies like our own, and many are constantly creating new stars. DJ Pisano, assistant professor of physics at West Virginia University, reveals a discovery that could explain why some galaxies show no signs of slowing star production.
Imagine that you have a friend who arrives at your house after driving across the country. Her car has a full tank of gas. Since you know that a car cannot travel thousands of miles without refueling, you can safely assume that your friend must have refilled her gas tank during her journey. You can think the same way about the universe. Since the amount of hydrogen gas in galaxies has remained remarkably constant over the past 10 billion years, despite galaxies converting large amounts of that gas into stars, we know that galaxies must have obtained more gas from their surroundings. So far, astronomers have only been able to find about 10% of the neutral hydrogen gas that galaxies need to acquire in order to sustain continued star formation and maintain their full tank of gas. Where is the missing gas? One possibility is that the hydrogen gas is so faint and diffuse that it has been missed in past surveys. This gas is predicted by current theories to be distributed in filamentary structures that feed the gas onto galaxies. Using the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia, my collaborators and I are looking for these structures. In a recent study of two galaxies, we find that both galaxies have some diffuse gas extending from their disks, but one appears to have a diffuse hydrogen filament that connects it with a couple of nearby galaxies. This filament may be the debris from a past close encounter of the galaxy with its neighbors. In this case, the filament should also contain stars. Alternatively, this filament may represent material falling onto the galaxy from intergalactic space, in which case such features should be common around other galaxies as well. We are now working to test both possibilities and unravel the mystery of where galaxies get their gas.
That was DJ Pisano of West Virginia University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.